So this is episode one of Gareth and George doing, talking about business, e-com, generally marketing, mergers and acquisitions for our kind of niche, the internet world. Before we start everything, we should give a bit of an intro as to us and our history in e-com and M&A, and I guess how we also met. So feel free to, you can go first.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to. Well, it's good to be here in, it's fucking hot in Barcelona. I don't know how you made it. I mean, I'm Canadian and you're Australian, so I'm just from cold Australia.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that I'd be struggling a lot here. But thank you for having me. And yeah, so I've been doing e-commerce stuff for 10 years, a little over 10 years. When I was in university back in Canada, I started a company called Rockwell Razors that makes eco-friendly all-metal safety razors. So you know when people cut up cocaine in movies with a razor blade?
Yeah.
So we make razors that like use those razor blades.
Old school.
Old school razors, but not all like Sweeney Todd all the way old school. And then people say like, oh, but Gareth, you have a razor company. You should, like, you don't, you have a beard. This isn't natural.
Yeah.
Like this, you gotta shave this, you gotta line this.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
So
line up here, I do the same thing, but line up
there. You go.
Yeah.
So you have a beard and need razors.
Yeah.
Everybody. So I started that company because I was in this, I was doing business and environmental science as my courses. So we celebrated that, like, you know, that Dollar Shave Club ad?
Yeah.
You know, everyone knows that one. So we spent like 2 hours celebrating that in like one class. And my very next class was about how birds choke to death on like razor blades that go to landfill. And I was like, oh, I'm a real piece of shit. I just had like 2 hours celebrating Dollar Shave Club. I was like, hold on, I bet that there are, like, why don't people use those old-timey recyclable razor blades anymore?
Yeah.
So I look into it. Gillette patented that. Gillette took, like, the old straight razor. That's what people had. And then in World War I, Gillette shipped, that's how it got really popular. They shipped out safety razors with, like, all of the, with the army. And so they had this patent on this safety razor. They called it a safety razor. But their patent eventually ran out. So I come out with the 2-blade cartridge. That runs out. 3-blade cartridge. 4, 5. Then they had lube strips and balls and stuff. So, like, that's the innovation in shaving is just as those major patents run out. And so I'm like, okay, well, that safety razor we created, that's not safe anymore. You've got to use these 2-blade cartridges because that's what we've got.
Wow.
So it's actually, like, you can just change the dimensions and those old-timey razors are still really good. So I just made it adjustable so that if you have, like, super thick hair, if you've got more like you're got Greek skin, right there, you could do it. If you just like really kind of finer hair that you need to shave on your head, you can do that with just one razor. And it took a number of years, but like we did a couple Kickstarter campaigns and it got big enough over time. And by 2018, I put a small management team in. They run it to this day. It's just owned by me and one other partner. And yeah, since then went on to, I co-founded a company called Keto. We raised some venture capital. Got that to like mid 7 figures of recurring revenue, and then COVID hit and people stopped caring quite as much about the ketogenic diet.
Yeah.
But it's still like a business still operates and is doing okay today. And then I went on and co-founded a brand called Lomi. And that's like a home composter. So it's like a little bit bigger than a toaster. You pop open the lid, you put in your food scraps, you push a button, turns it into dirt overnight that you can feed your plants. And that one bonkers. It did like $7 million in its first month on an Indiegogo campaign of all things. And yeah, went on to do like $100 million in revenue. I think just under $100 million in revenue in over the next like two and a half years. And then yeah, I'd kind of invested, so I stepped back from the brand at that point. And yeah, just been working on what's next since then. But that's me.
Well, my intro is not going to be that cool, but
it'll be cool.
Yeah. So, okay. So from the top, 100 mil.
It was crazy.
That's insane.
It was absolutely bonkers.
And for context, you're 31.
I am 31.
Yeah.
I look.
I think we both look much older than we are. I started back in Australia, born and raised there, but my background's Greek. And I started like working at McDonald's, doing construction. Unloading shipping containers and like super early and working like parents' business like cutting lawns and stuff.
Yeah.
From like 10th.
Fully.
And I'm like, this sucks. Like,
yeah.
Everyone in my family, all of my family ancestry worked in their hands.
Right.
Like manual labor.
Yeah.
And like quite quickly I'm like, I do not want to be doing this. So that's why I, especially working at McDonald's, that's when like I would be playing video games and on and like half the screen would be playing videos. I was just watching like YouTube videos nonstop.
Okay.
But I was not a TV kid. I didn't watch TV. but I just watched YouTube. I grew up on YouTube. And then you just did motivational videos would come out. I was like, and then like, I think it was Gary Vee came up.
Right.
Doing motivational videos. And then I'm like, oh, I'll grab the book. And I started reading entrepreneurial books. And then that's what got me into it. And then Gary Vee simply said in his crush book was like, create communities, monetize, hold up.
Right.
And at the same time, Facebook groups, I think, became popular, came out.
Right.
And I was like, so someone I knew was like, creating Facebook groups for students. I'm like, interesting. Within 24 hours, I made a proposal to him. He had like a tutoring company. So it made sense to create Facebook groups for students. I made a proposal. I'm like, pay me $2,000. I'll do the building of the groups since you're a uni student. I'm actually young, yeah, like a student. And he said, yeah. So do that for a month. He said, oh, we don't need servers. I'm like, I created like 50 groups for every year.
Yeah.
And then I would just add memes every day since I was already looking at memes every day.
No one's figured out that like a 14-year-old kid.
No one had idea. No one had any idea. But all it was like other 14-year-olds, other 15-year-olds, like every grade.
Yeah.
So they're just sending memes and the engagement was insane.
Right.
Like insane engagement. And I said, hey, if you like the group, like the page, you like the page, join the email list. If you want to, and then I'll put some like educational videos and notes. I'm like, hey, you want physics notes for year 9? Go to the website. And then I was like, okay. And then the MailChimp, like the $8 a week or whatever, I was like, I ain't paying for this. There's all these rich friends who get them dying at McDonald's for $5 an hour. I'm like, let me start monetizing. So I called up like a spring break company in Australia called Schoolies.
Okay.
And I said, let me sell your stuff. If can I sell your stuff for taking commission? They're like, sure. Good luck, kid. And I did like 130K in sales in the first month. They're like, we owe you like $5,000-$6,000. I'm like, yo, get some $1 billion in there.
Yeah.
And then I got a bunch of other referrals and stuff. I'm just an affiliate business and advertised everywhere, created multiple groups. And then eventually after 3 to 6 months, I sold it to either the Springway company, a tutoring company, or one of the other affiliates. And just kept selling and then building them and selling.
Right.
And that's when it got interesting with Instagram accounts, building those up, selling them, other Facebook groups. And then some of those clients, those affiliates were like, can you just do our marketing for Facebook or build a group of our own? I'm like, dope. More Lost Media, that's my marketing agency. And then it went from like just doing ads to doing ads and then doing the video creation as well. So like a full funnel agency. And that went, it happened over a couple of years. And all in all, there was always small stuff, acquisitions and exits I was doing.
Yeah.
But it was all like small time, Australia, sometimes to Americans. But I ended up selling the all the Facebook groups, except from one. And I launched, I added Instagram accounts and all that stuff. Eventually, I sold them like all after like 5 years from that point, by the time I finished high school. And the marketing agency was making pretty good money by the end, like by 2018.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I just sold my whole business. It was mainly for real estate agents and shopping centers. So we would just do a bunch of filming, edit it into like 50 different forms, and then they would advertise on TV, on socials, on everything. And I'm like, I'll sell you my ad, my customer list, and sold the agency. But part of the agency was always doing deals, M&A, for other e-com guys. So I'm like, and it was called e-commerce brokers. So I'm like, I'm going to take that. But I had that domain. Let me just plug it in.
Right.
And we went from there. Filled with e-commerce brokers. And there was always some small stuff on the side, but e-commerce brokers ever since 2017 went from like this part-time thing to full-time.
Yeah.
And then I like graduated from like Australia, which weirdly has like a lot of M&A, online M&A, like flippers, Australia.
Really?
Yeah, out of Melbourne. Yeah.
Oh, sure. I had no idea. I just know that the Australians are fantastic at e-commerce. I remember I heard about like Frank Body, like kind of early.
I was in weird.
Yeah.
Yeah. Especially Melbourne. No, really, especially I had so many sellers from Melbourne and the parties to Sydney. But yeah, there it doesn't even make sense. Like that big client that we're talking about that I have, Adelaide.
For really?
Yeah. Weirdly. Yeah. But and then you kinda look, I've done a lot of small things on the side, like equity deals and this and that, but I think the one thing I did very differently to every young person was focus on one thing.
Right.
Which was very weird.
Yeah.
And after like 20 nights, I'm like, just do e-commerce brokers. Like, if you actually run this well, it will work. I've had ups and downs here, but like the wins came from there. And now it's like, we mainly do North American clients. Like, we have a North American client, buy side or sell side. And it's begun good success. And that's how we met.
Yeah. That's how we met. Because I was looking at when all of the Amazon aggregation stuff was happening. Me and a couple other guys got together. We said, you know what? We should look at doing this for the Shopify space. And so we bought a Shopify business through you. That's how we were connected. And then we looked at the space as it was kind of emerging. Fortunately, we got out of that space before aggregation, like completely collapsed. So a little bit of like a knock on wood, good luck there. But like the business, it was a fantastic transaction. Yeah. And you and I just kept it, even though we didn't continue with this like aggregator, you and I were like, this is a great hang. Yeah. We should just keep in touch. And so here we are.
I think we clicked. We were like, oh, we're clients and we chat. But then last year when we were on the phone, and you're like, I remember you were like, we were talking about a bit about M&A and we're like, you're like, what else is up? I'm like, I don't know. I'm like, what is he doing? I'm like, oh, I don't know. I'm like, because I've always done like stand-up.
Yes.
For fun.
Yeah.
On the side. Especially for sales and stuff. It's always fun to push myself. I'm like, should I say it? I'm like, fuck it. I'm like, stand-up. And you're like, same. I'm like, yo.
Yeah, I think that's what we're going to be friends. We're going to be friends. Trying to get along. And then further, it got easier because I've like, I moved from, at the beginning of this year, moved from Toronto to now I live in London in the UK. So it's just like, it was the 2-hour flight this morning to come see you. So fantastic. Now we get to hang out.
And I think that's, and of course, like a couple of weeks ago, you're like, dude, we should just talk deals.
Yeah.
And like news in the space because no one's doing
this. It's crazy. Like I see the people kind of diligence, not e-commerce deals. Like there's all sorts of things because there's all these broker websites now.
No.
And people talk about buying, you know, they talk about those brick and mortar businesses, sweaty business, whatever, all this stuff. No one has really talked about like fundamentally how to diligence e-commerce businesses. So I think it'll be exciting because like I've only done e-commerce for 10 years, different businesses, but only e-commerce. It's the only thing that I know.
Yeah.
And you're obviously like brokered a ton of these things. So I think it'll be sweet to just like combo that. Just all I have is like operating experience with like you actually know what to look for as a broker.
So this we're going to do a new segment every episode, just things that I think are relevant in e-com that actually affect people and that everyone should know about. Now this one's pretty broad, AI in general and in e-commerce, and I always had the idea that we know that like the graph of like early movers to a trend, but AI really has developed quickly. In terms of there's a lot of people are using AI quite quickly, especially e-commerce. And when I saw the data point that 40% of e-commerce marketers are using AI actively, I'm like, that's getting pretty, like, that's a pretty big majority, much quicker than I expected. How do you think AI is really impacting e-commerce?
I think you can think of it in two angles. There's, can AI help with execution? And then I think where we're really going to see AI come into e-commerce is on decision-making.
Mm.
That's where, when people talk about co-pilots, the idea of co-pilots, I think supporting in decision-making is where we ultimately see this. So I guess that likely those 43% who are using it, we've heard of blog posts being written by ChatGPT. I'm an advisor to a company that that builds static ads just out of, they look at your existing ads library, see what's working in your ads library, pair that with what's kind of best practice out there in the universe, and combo that up and just spits out static ads.
Yeah.
So I think it wouldn't surprise me if a lot of those sorts of tools are being used when we look at that, like that 43%. What will get interesting to me ultimately is when we have the ability, and I think we're probably getting there very soon, where you can just plug in your Shopify, your financials, all that, and you'll be given some guidance on, hey, there are different elements of this business that you want to improve. At any given time, you probably want to increase your average order value so that you're getting more gross margin out of every order. You might want to be looking at conversion rate because if you can increase your gross margin and you've got your conversion rate is X and you can get it to X times 1.5, that's an enormous increase in profit out of the same amount of traffic.
Hmm.
Then you're going to look at like, okay, benchmarking this business against other businesses where they get their traffic from. You're underutilizing opportunities in organic. Here are several brands in your niche and several brands in other niches that are performing well on organic. You should look at like what they're doing and maybe try to emulate that. And then fourth, lifetime value. AIs would be able to look at, okay, your emails are underperforming, your SMS is underperforming, or you're not doing it at all. Your direct mail is underperforming, or you're not doing it at all. And so in aggregate, based on your financials, based on the goals that you, your company, your leadership, whatever has said that we have, AI would recommend you first work on your lifetime value, because that's the number one thing based on like the cash that you have on hand, your advertising budgets, like you need to generate some cash. And here are three different things on the LTV side that you can
do. Yeah.
I think that like that support on a decision-making level,
yeah,
that's going to get really, really interesting. Because right now, again, that 43%, I'm like, how much of that is ChatGPT help me with a blog post?
Exactly.
Okay, nice. Cool. Like 101. And then, yeah, I think we're now, Sora is going to come out soon. And by the time people are listening to this, maybe it's out. Like OpenAI is going to be platform, and then many others are going to be able to generate video ads. So there's the execution, but decision making is what's next.
I think that's super interesting because all of that is a lot of what we do at e-commerce focus for like seller exit advisory.
Right.
I'm like, why haven't you added a subscription? Why haven't you done this? Why haven't you done that?
Yeah.
Which is scary.
Yeah.
For brokers. But I agree. I think definitely the ads, like what you mentioned about ads, that's super interesting for marketers. I mean, one of the big things I see, and we actually do actively, when we're doing that exit planning with agencies, is that they rebrand with all, like, especially when they have their face on everything, you're throwing his face on their brand.
Yeah.
They put AI pictures straight away. Which is, like, we remember an agency we sold 2 months ago, they changed the owner's face on the company to AI.
Really?
Yeah.
Just to kind of separate that, like, personal.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But, so it's, in very small ways, like blog posts, like, okay, it's nothing huge.
Yeah.
But I think ads is where it gets interesting. I don't know if, in terms of like effectiveness of the ads, like, I think that's the question. When does that get really good? Like, when ads get really effective, AI ads get really effective?
Well, I mean, in a way, we've been living in an AI delivered ads environment for a while now. So when we think about, you hear about like Advantage Plus on Meta's platform, or Performance Max through Google. That's just like predominantly AI-driven ad delivery. And I think that was really brought on by the iOS 14 kind of like privacy adjustments that were made. Like, okay, we're going to have to, those platforms are removing a lot of the tools out of necessarily an in-house media buyer's hands. And a lot of that targeting is now being driven by AI. And they're not yet enforcing it, but it's very heavily encouraged. So I think where there's still leverage and you hear everyone talk about it is still on creative. So like your ultimate lever in your advertising as an e-commerce brand is in your creative. And now we're I don't know, we'll have to revisit this conversation in 6 months.
No, because they update so quick.
Super quick. It will just be really interesting once we've got the ability for AI to execute on the creative. Now what actually is going to be differentiating brands? I guess it's like the creative direction, the creative strategy. Yeah. Ultimately, is creative strategy replaced by AI? So I think we're really at this point where, like, I can appreciate 4 out of 10, 43% of marketers using it. I think it becomes like you have to find your edge on how you can co-pilot with it.
What about the opposite? Like, I see a lot of not a lot, but I see a few brands where they're like, I'm not trying to scale this to the moon necessarily with AI and all these like softwares, like. I look at Nick Bear. I don't know if you know Nick Bear. He's like a hybrid athlete on.
Oh yeah, okay, yes.
And he has his like performance-based nutrition, whatever it is.
Sure.
But he's using genuine is a tough word for people who use steroids. But like, he's using his personal brand and like community and his experiences with people and his vlogs and all that.
Yeah.
As advertisement for his brand.
Sure.
Now that's the opposite of AI in some ways. Like that is very one person,
like human-driven.
Yeah.
Story.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think, how much do you think being like authentic, genuine from a human kind of marketing and organic marketing, let's call it, or influencer marketing, is actually going to become more important to people who are like a bit anti-AI in the way that, like, if I saw a picture of an AI face, I'm like, get out of here, dude. I don't want to see this. I'm talking to a person.
I think at the end of the day, humans inherently, we've known this forever, humans do crave connection. So I think we're just going to see this bifurcation. Like you have the elements that are AI driven, AI delivered, but I think you can't pick a spot in between if you're a brand. It really has to be kind of this, like, you can either be fully commoditized and you see a lot of that. I mean, dude, you see these deals all the time. You'll call me and be like, oh my God, like there's just sometimes people are just coming out. There's a wave of some trendy product and it's all kind of generic and drop shipped. So like, that way of building e-commerce brands, and I shudder, hesitate to even use the term brands for it, but like that's just going to become AI. I think it'll be tougher for those people to sell. But I think the ones that have human, either meaningful product innovation or meaningful, defensibility that people actually care about and want, or kind of a meaningful human narrative. That's what's going to be most important to people.
I know we talked about like personal brand.
Yeah.
I think it's going to become more and more important because...
an authentic one, not like just a generic one, but you know, there's tons of people who just have AI writing these like generic Twitter threads on like six ways to crush the morning.
I see it on LinkedIn too. I'm like, you didn't write that.
No.
Give me a break.
Also, like, this is just a variation on something that I read yesterday.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And that's why I have a low tolerance for bullshit. So I'm like, this is just AI. You don't give a shit. If you don't give a shit to write it, I don't give a shit to read it.
Yeah.
I'm very anti-AI in that way. Like, I understand using it as a tool, but at the end of the day, like, there's some services, and I say this to a broker, it's like, a lot of my competitors, they try and broker with minimum effort. They bring in employees, they're like, just try and close the deal if it's easy. If you don't grind it to the
end, it's a sell shop.
Yes. Send it on the email thing. If you don't like it, who gives a shit?
Right.
Because I'm like, if I'm about to make six figures commission, I shouldn't be working like I'm about to make six figures commission.
Yeah.
And that, all my clients have the same thing. Like, you pick up the phone pretty much any time. You get a call get on a phone or get an email, reply to emails very quickly.
That's the thing. I never know what time zone you're in.
Yeah,
I'm
not
an issue. I don't know what time,
never sleeps. But it's like, if I'm going to make ridiculous commissions, I should work out.
Yeah.
And I see this, we have a deal now. We're trying to bid on it with a New York buyer. It's like 10.5 mil. The guy, we were interested initially. We put in an offer around 8.9. And then he went with another buyer, 3 months under offer, didn't go anywhere. And then I'm like, not on the LOI. You didn't need us back up. I had to find out again just from looking on the internet.
Yeah.
There's like, if you're making 10% commissions, you're about to make $1 million. Maybe call 500K if you commission to the low end. That ain't worth sending an email.
Yeah.
Like the workload that people want to use is so low. And when I see that, they're like, let's just use AI as an easy fix, I'm like, dick. I mean, a lot of people said, like Gary Vee always says, like, do things that are unscalable for a while. Just like, I'm not too opposed to that, even now, in the age of AI. And then it's like, how good does AI get at even doing that stuff that seems human? That's when it's like, you know what, fair enough.
And that's all I had to revisit in 6 months. Because we don't know.
Cool. So the other point of news is... I pulled a bunch of data from the news.
Oh, I can see that.
Retail sales.
This is great, by the way, for anyone. You've done all this prep work. Yeah. I've just showed up. And so I've been seeing all this stuff basically for the first time. So you get my raw, honest takes on all this stuff.
Yeah. So what I've seen is that retail sales across the board, whether it's restaurants, so like, for example, where do we see that? So first things first, Best Buy's annual earnings went down from $43 billion to $42
billion. Got
the opposite direction. From what they were thinking things were going to go. Nordstrom missed their earnings expectations. Target's fiscal first quarter earnings missed estimates as sales actually went down 3% year on year. Target, Walmart, and even McDonald's have cut prices and introduced more like promos and deals to bring in people who are like more bargain hunting than anything. Home Depot as well missed revenue. Walmart has identified people are buying groceries, so like necessities over, not necessities. What do you think that means for e-commerce and the next 12 months?
Yeah, it's interesting because like this is now getting almost into like macroeconomics, which I'm far from qualified to speak on. But I think what this all signals to me is we're beginning to see the impact of those kind of increased interest rates and like that uncertainty. People just aren't sure where they're going to be at financially. So again, like I feel like I'm using the term again, but like that bifurcation, we're just going to see how the rich are going to continue to spend quite a lot and everyone else just necessarily has to be a little bit more cautious. Yeah. So all of these are enormous, massive brands, Best Buy, Nordstrom, Target, Walmart. If they're missing revenue, I think that more speaks to people holding, like they're still, we know people are making big purchases. I think they're just being more cautious. They're waiting. They're maybe deal hunting. So that's likely why we're seeing people come out with these price cutting kind of initiatives just to bring people back into stores.
Yeah.
So what it means for e-commerce, again, to me, like those brands that are selling to people with money, we're just going to end up seeing more and more those kind of like luxury brands doing really well.
Yeah.
E-commerce is amazing because you can build up a community. You can build up kind of the way that your brand is going to be perceived so quickly just by digital affiliation, by bringing on influencers and creators. You really can kind of create something that is perceived as high-end very quickly and target that segment of the market. And then the rest of it, I think it's going to be, it's going to be like tough going if you're not in that like really high AOV or inherently long LTV type markets. It's like longer lifetime values on fairly high margin premium products that have that like that high perceived brand value. I think it's just going to be really, really tough. And we're seeing that in any VC-backed startup. This is a terrible time for like the VC-backed startups that started in the 2017, 2018 onwards that aren't really targeting the highest end type customer.
Yeah.
Commodity, like Dollar Shave Club was sold to Unilever, and I think they just like fire sold it to, some like random private equity company. Just because, again, like it's really difficult to sell cheap stuff on the internet because you're competing with anything and everything.
The commodity, the sea of commoditized
life. Right. Like, and there's no barrier now to even listing a commodity. Before you had to figure out all sorts of things.
Yeah.
Now it's so easy. And so with that, I think comes price pressure and there goes the profits. And
when do you think things are going to get better? Is it just like, and I guess the bigger question is when do you think interest rates are going to go down?
Oh God, I have no idea. All I know is that there continues to clearly be, if you're able to go out and build a community of people who are kind of like raving, it comes down to, can you build a product within e-commerce that has strong gross margins, strong conversion rates, you've got affordable sources of traffic, and you've got some mechanism to drive lifetime value? If you can identify opportunities to do those, and that's like, that's a 5-second like little audio clip, but very difficult. Because if you're going to rely entirely on paid ads, I think that era's gone. Mm. You need to have some sort of unfair advantage going in. So that, whether that's community, and frankly, community is probably the best thing that you could be doing. Like have a meaningful amount of hooks that are driving organic traffic into a brand. I'd be very scared to start a brand today.
Yeah.
I'm fairly selective with the brands that I've started historically. The reason I'm like, I'm really taking my time to pick the next one is I want to pick something where there's like a meaningful opportunity for organic traffic.
One piece of news that feels like it's contradictory to the trend is that Amazon reached 180 million Prime subscribers now, which is literally half of the US population.
Yeah.
That blows my mind.
Well, think about it's the commodities we were talking about.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know many people who go on Amazon to discover new higher-end brands. I actually don't know anyone who kind of says like, oh my God, you wouldn't believe this amazing brand that I found on Amazon.
Exactly.
No one really says that. You might hear every so often kind of this interesting product that they found.
One thing I see with luxury brands, and I've always liked the idea of going higher end.
Yeah.
Because that's what I do with mine. I'm like, I'm still like 300 businesses a year.
Right.
But I'm making nothing on all of them.
Right, on the little ones.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm like, let's do 30. I made really great commissions.
Right.
And it worked. And with big trends like right now, retail is having a hard time. If you are a luxury brand, it feels like you're in the bottom of the sea and there's a massive storm on the surface.
Sure.
You're all the way down at the bottom and it's pretty calm.
Yeah.
Because you just have your little bubble.
Yeah.
And it's just, and like, that's what I see in my business. Weirdly, it's the best year I've ever had in the last 12 months. And last year as well, it's like, e-com is dying. Even e-com M&A, there's just less deals being done.
Mm-hmm.
But I just have a good community of buyers and sellers who are like, yeah, George, we have other business here. We're from like...
Right. It's repeat buyers.
Yeah.
Yeah. And probably sellers who kind of have a system. So they come into you with multiple deals. You're bringing them to kind of your repeat trusted buyers.
Yeah. And I assume it's the same for DTC brands as well.
If you've got a kind of proven methodology, you feel confident in being able to spin up brands. Look, there's tons of information out there. Like, if you wanted to start a brand today, everything you need to know is on YouTube.
Exactly.
Like, YouTube. Like, it's not difficult at all to kind of figure out how to start a brand, but it really comes down to, like, understanding your fundamental metrics and really do your math to understand, like, what are you going to have to pay to acquire customers?
Yeah.
And a lot of it comes down to, again, the gross margin, that you need to have good gross margin. or you have to be able to finance a very strong lifetime value. So you get your gross margin over time,
yeah,
but you're probably not going to be able to afford to acquire those customers profitably on the first order. So you need to have like the sophistication to be able to finance that customer acquisition. That's fucking hard.
Yeah.
And you've got to understand your community so that when you do drive traffic, you're speaking to them in a way that it converts. Because
yeah,
traffic's expensive, or if you've built a community so you can get it for free, then that's why I think we're seeing a lot of the creator-driven brands.
Yeah.
And even that, like, I think Mr. Beast, like, turned off his e-commerce for Feastables. Because, I mean, it was lower AOV. Yeah. I imagine that had, I don't know anyone in there, but I imagine that that's why that wasn't working. It just makes a lot more sense in retail for chocolate bars.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I think I see that also with, I mean, across the board with, because we get a lot of influencers come to sell their brands.
Okay.
And you take the organic ad, it's nothing. It is not a business.
Right. Which is why they want to sell it.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm like, no, it's fantastic that you've done this organically, and because you're not paying for any ads.
Yeah.
As soon as you do, that's it.
Yeah.
And I've yet to see anyone with a sub $10 million business be able to like even remotely diversify. They're from their personal brand. If he started as a personal brand, it's very hard to to diversify.
You need a really specialty kind of buyer.
Yeah.
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 Who really understands that.
But yeah, speaking of small deals, so we're going to get into a few different small deals now. So it's an Aussie guy selling the business. It is based in Australia. It's focused on the Australian market. And with all Australian businesses, the idea is, as every seller will say, we can expand to the US. This is one of my listings, and I'll be honest.
Yeah.
Anytime someone says they can expand, whether it's from the US to Europe or Europe to US, Australia to US, if you haven't validated it, it's not worth even mentioning.
Right.
And also, it's potential. We're not here to talk about what could happen.
Yeah, that's you have to buy on what cash flow that it's actually generating, because you've got to assume that this is being bought with some degree of debt that has debt service along with it. So right now we're looking at a business that does, I mean, they're saying 11%, let's call it 10% net margin, just for easy math.
Yeah.
So we've got a business that's just under $2 million in annual revenue, putting 10% on the bottom line.
Yeah.
They've got an AOV of $60.
Okay. Yeah. The thing that I like about the business, and I actually haven't put this in the notes because it's really new news. It's so the brand's been around for a couple of years. It's a skincare product. It essentially is like the patches that women put under their eyes.
Oh yeah,
like face paint.
Oh yeah, here it is. Okay,
which is super popular, and they're doing very well now. The thing is, when I first turned to the seller, I said, what's the subscription revenue? He said, what?
Oh.
So he started that.
Okay.
And they have like 700 people subscribed already in the last 3 months.
Okay.
So that is super interesting, right? We got one offer for that this business this week. It's been listed for about a week or maybe 2 weeks. Now, the question is, the valuation is $350K, which is a bit on the higher end, but we need to start a bit on the higher end. The deal will probably land around $300K USD. The selling point for me is the subscription revenue, and that's going quite well. Now, it's a small Aussie brand, so it's for an Australian buyer who's interested in the Australian market. For American buyers, it's not so interesting because owning Aussie businesses at r.com.au is always a pain. You have to set up an entity in Australia through there. So it's a bit of a mess for American buyers. But with the subscription revenue, it represents some value with some self-financing. That's the take. Well, what are your thoughts on it? Feel free to tear it up.
Yeah. Well, let's take a look. So, I mean, I just went through the subscription flow. It seems like they've got a decent kind of like tech stack here. I actually like the website itself. I can tell that they've done some good work on like the conversion rate optimization side. So like fundamentally the site itself, strong. Totally commoditized product. Like this, I can go on Alibaba and find this, no problem. So, I mean, it's interesting to see that this is netting out to 10% margins, because I'm looking at this can't be that expensive to manufacture at all. And they're selling it for quite a lot. So that kind of makes sense though at these AOVs. It's a low AOV. That's what I would want to do with this business. When I'm looking at it right away, I'm like, how can you get this to be a much higher AOV? Because I suspect what they're struggling with, especially based on, look at this. So I think that they're right now selling about 26, just under 27,000 units a year.
Yeah.
Based on just, I did some division of like their AOB by the overall revenue. They have half of that on hand in inventory. So that's a bit of a red flag. That's interesting. That's a lot of inventory to have on hand. It's a lot of time. Like, it literally just represents, like, if you're only turning over inventory twice a year. That's interesting. So I wonder if, like, maybe there's some pressure there on the seller that they kind of need to get this off their books. Who knows? My suspicion is that it's going to be a little bit of a tougher one to finance because the AOVs are lower. You're going to be mostly getting your value from a customer in their repeat purchases.
Yeah.
Right? Like, 60, I'm just going to pretend that these are US numbers, even though they're Australian dollars, like $60 AOV, I don't care what English-speaking territory you're in, like, even if your COGS plus fulfillment costs are very low, unless you've got some incredible organic acquisition hook, or you've got, like, the most robust affiliate network, which it doesn't look like they do. So I assume that there's a lot of Facebook ads, Google ads, they listed that here, like, that's what's driving a lot of this traffic. So that must be expensive traffic. So it would be interesting to see, out of this 1.6 million that they've made in revenue, how much of that is going towards ads. Like, that's probably an important breakdown to understand. Because you're right, like, then if you do want to expand it into other territories, you've got to, like, educate an entire new territory on this, you know, on this brand.
That's the thing with a lot of these skincare brands and niches, is like, and the innovation in products, like, okay,
so fast.
He's like, this buyer of this business isn't going to expand to the US, and it's going to be something new.
Yeah.
It's the opposite way around. Like, the US is where innovation usually starts.
Yeah.
And then an Aussie brand will copy it. Then a European brand will copy it.
Right.
But yeah. Okay, cool. Well, let's hop on to the next small deal. So this is a distressed asset. The seller isn't afraid to admit it. It's chugging along. It's hasn't massively tanked, but the seller's life circumstances has said, look, I have a lot of shit going on.
Yeah.
He doesn't want the responsibility of owning it, but he worked within it without issue. This niche of kids' toys has actually, we've seen maybe 4 or 5 multi-million dollar listings over the past 12 months in this niche. This being one of them. This was listed a year ago not with us.
Yeah.
For someone else. For one of our buyers, actually. And we said, we'll take it on if we put it at a reasonable price.
Okay.
And yeah, so he's willing to finance, like, earn out, do a bunch of, like, to get it across the line. This is very indicative of the types of deals that are done for businesses who went through COVID.
Yeah.
Did good numbers. Now they are not doing so great. And a lot of sellers are burnt out. They're demoralized by the figures that have transpired in the last 12 months. Now they're like, see what we can do. Can we get rid of it? I'll step back from owning the business. I'll have 10% equity. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. So this is definitely in the realm of kind of outfitting your home, right? I can see how that would be really relevant during COVID. I like their AOVs, this $200, $250 AOV. You said this is an Aussie brand?
US.
This is a US brand, yeah. Okay. So I like the AOVs, but it's heavy. These are big. So this is going to be expensive to ship. So again, when you're going back to that, like, first lever of e-commerce, you're thinking about, like, what's the offer / AOV? How much gross margin room do you fundamentally have when you're selling this? I don't know. What I'm not seeing as much as I might expect is them encouraging bundling. So if someone's already spending this much on kids' toys, say it like it is. Getting kids nice things nowadays, inherently almost getting into, like, luxury brand territory. There's lots of stuff out there talking about, like, people are having fewer kids just because kids are expensive. Like, it's an actual financial decision that people are making. So then going out with buying kind of higher end expensive stuff for your kids, in my mind, I'm like, these people are already spending quite a lot of money. Yep. Why not lean more into that? So I'm surprised at sort of the lack of bundling, because a lot of these things would go together quite nicely. I think that you could do a good job of, like, upselling stuff. So that's a bit of an opportunity if you're looking at it. I like they don't have too much inventory on hand, so things are probably, like, turning pretty nicely. I like their gross margin. Like, well, even their net margin, like 18%. So this business is being run fairly efficiently. So I think if you're looking at buying this, you'd have to be reasonably certain that you've got some way to grow the business. But if you could grow it, if you have the ability to plug it into, I don't know, some sort of creator in like the children's,
yeah,
in the kids,
like space. A mom.
Yeah, like a mom or family influencer kind of situation. You never know, dad influencer. Anything can happen.
Yeah.
None of my halos. I think if you're able to drive strong organic traffic to this, it's a great segment for retargeting. Yeah. You've got a big enough AOV that, like, right now they say they're doing paid social, Meta and Google. My guess, just based on what I'm seeing, is they're probably not doing a lot of YouTube ads. At this AOV, assuming their gross margins aren't terrible, I think they probably actually could expand their paid ads channels if they're able to go out and kind of like leverage, again, more organic traffic. So if someone's got a good way to juice this full of traffic,
yeah,
this looks like a really nicely kind of like baseline built out asset.
In terms of defensibility, it's interesting.
It's a little interesting, yeah.
It's a little interesting. They have licensing agreements.
Yeah.
They have exclusive manufacturing agreements and trademarks. At the end of the day, though, a lot of their products are going for ridiculously cheap.
Yeah.
On other sites.
Okay.
I forget how much they sell on Amazon. I don't think it's very much. But that's the thing. I saw maybe two other businesses that sell the exact same thing.
Yeah. Well, they've got this one license. This is interesting. Yeah. But now, like, here, this one, you're clearly buying a bit of a job, right? It's not just buying a business, but if you've got to go execute more of these children's relevant IP licensing type agreements. And that's a ton of work.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. I think the only deal to be done here, and we're seeing this, but I'm saying this to buyers, is, and there's some decent amount of cash up front so the seller can relieve stress.
Yeah.
He'll stay on as an employee, as an extended support period. He'll even do an earnout and a bit of seller financing. Like, it's a very creative way to do a dealy. And again, I think this is indicative of a lot of businesses like this where, hey, would you pay 100% up front for it? Absolutely not. Would you take it on? Absolutely not. But in terms of earnout, self-financing, staying on as an employee / support period, there's something here. It would need to be negotiated thoroughly, but I think there's a deal here.
Yeah, I do like that they're going to get around the crazy tariffs because the product's not coming out of China. That's interesting too. So there's a little bit of something. Someone's figured out something different and interesting here.
Yeah.
I'd want to know more about why the founder wants out, though. That would be
important.
So if he's like, I know, wants out, but he's willing to stick around for an earnout, I'm like, oh, that's interesting. Like, that's a differentiated kind of...
To be honest, he's just had a divorce.
Okay.
And he's like, I got it. He's...
Yeah. There's a need for... Okay. So, like, you never know. Like,
To be honest,
there could be...
Like, as we say this to buyers, he's like, dude, to be honest, like, we have to be honest with buyers, like, I've just been burnt out. And that's what he said. Like, we have this on the list. Like, he's burnt out from the divorce, from ups and downs of COVID. Like, it's a good business for its size, but it's just struggling with the current state of, like, traffic and consumer spending.
Yeah.
But during COVID, it was killing it.
Yeah.
Right. But that's the thing. I mean, now, this is a good example of deals that came to the market that were too expensive when they were listed.
Yeah.
And when things were good, they're like, yeah, these offers aren't good enough. But now we're like, hey, like,
yeah,
let's really get rid of this now.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd buy it for this listed price. I don't know if I'd take it there. But I think there's probably someone who is able to put organic traffic through this could probably have a decent time with it, assuming that you could structure the deal right. I don't know if I'd put as little money up front as possible, hopefully some seller financing.
Yeah.
That could be interesting.
And that's the thing, like, what I consider to be a good broker, I said to the seller, you know, we're going to be doing there's going to be seller financing, right? Because, I know, I'm like, and earn out. Like, this is going to be a structured deal, creating a new structured deal.
I think it has to be.
But yeah, okay, cool.
And so he then needs to be very selective on that buyer.
Yeah.
To find a buyer that he'd be confident that he's going to get the structure
exact
part of the deal.
Okay, so another listing. So this is website closes, business, smaller size, valuation is 1.3 mil. SJP qualified, 25 years in business, pond and garden supply, Amazon and D2C sales. So the first thing I see when I see that is like, okay, what percent Amazon, right?
Deals of this size, you've seen this before, we've talked about this. The financials are always fucked up.
Yeah. It's between 1 and 10% off. And then not to mention the...
If they're prepared.
If they're prepared. Now, if they're not, it's like... Like we
remember that one deal we looked at where like they didn't have financials prepared. It was like a CMOS deal. Do you remember that one?
Yeah,
they were shocked that we wanted to see financials.
That was such a
headache. And they had to like rush. They were like, oh, and they shit it out in like Excel.
Yeah,
and they were like, here are financials.
It was like five rows.
No, yeah, like no auditing, no like no categorization. It was crazy. Anyways,
I'm sure that's not long ago.
Yeah,
but yeah, like I mean, we see this now. We put down an offer about a week or two ago. For a yoga business. I know we've done a yoga.
Oh, yeah.
But for this yoga business, and like the seller just spends a lot of her time in the business. Now, I always say to buyers, like, whatever time the seller says they put into the business, it's usually double.
Yeah, it's way more.
Way more.
Yeah.
And look, that's one, sure, they're trying to save, make it sound like less, because we need to associate a cost to their time for like a manager.
Well, and they want to position it as that it's sellable because it's more of an asset. It's not.
And even if they are being honest, they're hyper efficient. They're hyper, like they're very good at it for someone to come
in. They know the categories super well. They've been doing
it
for years.
Exactly. So like when I see great minds, I'm immediately like, can't. I'm believing you. That can't be true. Now I like this business. I like aged businesses, and there has been a trend of, like, I might have seen, like, each week when I sit down with my team to pick businesses for my buyers, one or two a week, max would have been 20 years old. Now, every week I'm seeing three or four new businesses that are 15 years or older. And one of the old ones are coming in and are like, something has happened in the last year or two that even old brands that are pretty evergreen are like, you know what, I'm looking to exit. I think this is part of, I mean, they said they were listed on Amazon in 2006.
So you've been doing this for a bit, but you know, we're talking the adjacent to the furniture space, which is like furniture e-commerce is almost all dropship. So I've scrolled down, increase the number of products that are dropship. So I'd be really interested to know like which trend line the net margins, especially gross margins on this business are, because dropship, you're going to just get a lot lower margins. So like if you're dropship, that means that your kind of unfair advantage, so to speak, is that you've got reliable traffic. It's not often that you can make really good margin drop shipping through like entirely paid ads. I think it's 2024. I think those years are predominantly behind us, you know, albeit what the YouTube gurus say, is that you can start a dropship business anytime. Typically not a great business. If you want an actual business, if you just want to like churn and burn Facebook ads, it's not the life I want, but fine. Lots of dropship, lots of FBA, 30 primary vendors. That's a lot, okay? Like, that's all a lot of different vendors. Like,
all US.
Yeah, okay. A lot of the company's vendors are willing to dropship for them. So yeah, I think I'd really want to understand, if I'm deeply diligencing this business, I'd want to understand where this organic traffic that they claim they get is coming from. It's including maximizing their SEO program, it says, which includes a blog on their website. Well, we know how volatile that is. If SEO is your moat, we talked about at the top of this, like, that's the number one thing that AI sort of came for. I think I'm really nervous about an SEO moat for something as not necessarily defensible as a gardening e-com.
I mean, and that's what a lot of the old businesses like this have, is great SEO, because they've been around for so long. They've been doing a couple articles every year for bloody 25 years.
But why do they only have 27,000 email subscribers?
They are probably just... How old do you think these owners are?
I think that they're not young.
Yeah, exactly. Because, and so this is the trend now, because all the, Cody Sanchez, I was saying, all the baby boomers are retiring their brick and mortar businesses. Well, any of the baby boomers who had online businesses are also looking to retire.
Yeah.
So
and it says that this was a brick and mortar business and they transitioned. Yeah. Okay.
So that's what I think this trend is. Like, why I have seen more 15-year-plus businesses being listed is because, same thing, baby boomers are looking to sell their businesses. And the question is, who are the buyers of these businesses? Who do you think buys this? What's the actual move for this?
Yeah. I think you have to pair it up with like someone who's got, again, good organic reach. I think there's with Kevin a lot, like Epic Gardening, we did a partnership with him on Lomi.
Yeah.
So that's like an example. Like he's got obviously a huge YouTube kind of media property. He's great. Really nice guy. And like he's built a great business. I think they've taken on some private equity. Like that, when you've got actual exposure already, on the media side.
What was your cash, commissions, affiliate, or equity?
For this one? Oh, for bringing on. I think like I'd probably try to pair it up with someone who's actually got that audience. Like,
yeah,
there are those, there are wealth managers and like general business managers for a lot of these creators make pretty good money.
Yeah.
They're then going to buy real estate, they got stock. Like, I think that probably the next thing that we're going to start seeing is more and more of those creators, like A-list celebrities, lots of examples of A-list celebrities buying businesses and kind of using their credibility to, whether it can be direct to consumer, it could be an alcohol brand, like yeah. like we've got Ryan Reynolds, tons of actors do alcohol brands. I mean, that's not an e-commerce thing, that's just like you recognize the name, you're gonna order it. I think that digitally native creators will be able to drive a lot of traffic to brands like this. So again, this really comes down to that, can you maintain the unfair advantage of whatever is driving traffic at this time? SEO, I don't know, that's a little nebulous. Like moderately worried about that, but if you can pair it up with talent, that becomes interesting. But then I think the question becomes, if you've got gardening talent, why would you not just reach out to some of the dropship type vendors and build it yourself? Or better yet, build your own brand. Exactly. And like,
you're not going to pay 1.3 million
for $350,000 of cash flow again.
Yeah,
like what?
Well, I see that with like I see like Jocko Willink. I mean, a lot of what he's doing, I mean, he's always done books, but a lot of what he's doing is like supplements, which is not anything new.
Yeah,
but I see a long
great margin. So I think that's why we see, if you've got audience, like it's just one is skincare supplements. Like those are the two main things that we sort of see people get it, because it's just, there's tons of manufacturers for it. You can really, it's not difficult to pick a partner. You do a little bit of innovation on a formulation, or you don't, and you just put like a big recognizable name on it. So I didn't know Jocko was doing that, but it certainly makes sense. I think any of you've got traffic going through, so you just want to make sure that stuff stays within your ecosystem.
And I think like it really doesn't, I think people, especially celebrities and influencers, overestimate how much product innovation is needed to be a bit, to be different. Like we had a women's handbag for women for months, essentially.
Yeah.
She added two straps and smaller the changes in design than she could get exclusivity from for the product from the supplier, which is a level of defensibility most businesses do not have.
Yeah.
And that little bit of defensibility, one, makes your product much better than the rest, with a lot more loyalty from her audience. And that defensibility, even just that contract, is so much better for a buyer, and that's why it got bought for, like, I think it was 3.9 multiple, compared to other businesses in the same price range. I mean, I don't think it's that difficult to find products to change the price, to innovate the products, if you use the product over a 6 to 12 month period, and then launch it as your own with a bit more defensibility.
I think that's right. So that's if you're looking at something like this and you've got a ton of audience on the gardening kind of front, if this is hyper relevant to your audience, in my mind, what you're doing is you're paying to accelerate that like brand development side.
Those 24 years you're set up, or 25, you don't need to do, even though it'd probably be 3 years to build a replica.
You're paying for time.
Yeah.
You're paying for time. And then you just, I'd be looking and hoping to God that like whatever is working well historically for them, that what I'm doing as a creator's team, whatever is going to drive that organic traffic, I'm hoping that that's in addition to what's already been working. But if that goes away, like now you're kind of fighting for your life to get it back to where it was. Like, you don't want to be struggling to cover debt payments or anything like that. That's brutal.
Yeah. No, I think as a broker's perspective on this is like, this business would have been so easy to sell 2 years ago or 3 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And people would be fighting over it. Now it's like, It's, I mean, look, if it's SBA led, it is SBA led.
I think it is.
I think the buyer for this is someone who's like, I just want something that'll tick along, and maybe in 2 to 3 years, it'll really take off. But for someone who's like quite actively wants return and wants growth, then this is
risky.
It's risky, exactly.
Yeah.
Especially with any loans you might have to take on it. And I know Westside closes pretty well. They won't offer anything more than like 50% or even
because of some crazy valuations. They're really strict.
But yeah, cool. Again, another deal. This is a big deal. It is another website closes one. Their valuation is 18 million.
Oh, it's a big one.
Yeah.
You found a big one.
3 million cash flow.
Cash flow.
The business is 3 years old.
Got it. What?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's 5 employees.
Okay.
20 mil rev. Now, the big thing that they've talked about is they've gotten Taylor Swift. They've gotten Kylie Jenner as influencers. It's all going through their website. It's 40% repeat order rate over what period? Now, the first thing I question, repeat order rate, I do love a good repeat order rate. However, over what period? Because if this business is 3 years old, it's just been over the COVID times. Their repeat order rate now can't be as good as it was. Or are we talking about year to date? Are we talking about last 12 months? What is that repeat order rate over, like, you know, where did that piece of data come from? So, okay, the influencer strategy seems pretty good. Now, look, operations, I said the company's team consists of one employee and 4 contractors. Now, I assume the owner is the employee and the 4 contractors. Now, it's either this is a business that makes really good money, but they don't have operations and they're going to need it very soon, or the business is not so good in terms of revenue, like the margins aren't what they say they are, and the operations don't actually need to be that good. And there's something not right here, because no one's doing 3 mil profit with 1 full-time employee. And also, like, I've seen this with buyers who've come to me and they've said they bought a business that's heavy influencer focused, and after that, the connection with the influencers no longer exists, and they actually make no money.
Yeah,
trailing 12 months.
Yeah, this is like, so I think you know this. I CMO'd a phone case brand before. Yeah. Like when I, so Lomi ended up bigger than Pila Case, but Lomi was spun out of, like, we started a friend of mine, Matt Bertulli, the founder of Pila Case, and Lomi, we started a startup studio together. And our observation was, incidentally, phone cases are, it's a tough business because people only buy a new phone every so often. And yes, there are some people who buy a bunch of phone cases for their phone to pair up with their mood of the day, or they're like buying them for friends. Like, some people have a bunch of different phone cases. Some people don't have a case on their phone at all. And some people are like you and I, who just like buy one case, don't think about it. So phone case is a really, really tough business. That's why we're like, hey, Pila Case has this fairly meaningful community of people who are engaged with the idea of an eco-friendly product. What are other product categories and products that we can get into? So we tried personal care and pet care. We spun up a kind of a newsletter like The Hustle, but for like eco news. And Lomi. And like Lomi was so disproportionately successful that we like sold or shut down all of the other things. And that helped make Pila Case make sense. I think now Pila Case is profitable. It took it to a good kind of level of profitability, but like it takes time. You had to really get your you had to get your library of designs up. Like, it's that long tail that ends up being really meaningful. This business hasn't been around for a very long time.
Yeah,
they're really, I'm on their website just because I peeped your screen, like, they're really leaning into these sort of influencer connections. So it is, it looks like it's one employee and 2 founders. Right. So they've carved out, so it's 2 founders have hired 1 employee and then these 4 contractors. This is really based around, it must be, the founders are connected to these celebrities. Like, these are
really the biggest.
These are the biggest names.
Taylor Swift?
Like, these are enormous names, celebrities.
Next is God.
Right, like, truly, this is, it's all the way. So, like, I think they've done a fairly good job on coming out. Like, look at all these skews.
Yeah, they're
like,
a million.
And by the way, this is a nightmare operation.
Yes.
Like, to maintain all of the molds that you need to actually manufacture this.
Insane.
Like, mold management, like, at the factory, because they've got, this is plastic injection molding, right?
Yeah.
So, you literally need to have a mold. And then it goes through the line. But, like,
yeah.
Even just for... Look at all the phone cases that they're maintaining.
What are you there?
That's so many molds. Assuming that they're doing it. Or this is, like, drop ship that's, like, licensed for... Like, I'm surprised that they've been able to get this many sort of proprietary molds made up in this amount of time.
And they said they have valuable IP assets.
Like, to the, that's all... That's where I got the molds. Like, that's all that that could be. I don't know if it's designs... Valuable IP assets. Well, okay. So, like, that scares the shit out of me. Like, yes. if whatever they're, because look at the profit that they claim that they're putting through. Like, that's very meaningful profit margins for a phone case company. That's a really difficult category. They're also claiming, like, a big opportunity is to expand the brand onto Amazon. At these price points, this is not going to crush Amazon. You might be able to collect a couple of people who are doing a brand search. I don't know how many people are searching for this brand, given that it's kind of this new. So that scares the shit out of me. That scares the absolute shit out of me.
And the multiple they have on it?
Absurd.
Is six?
Yeah. It's absurd.
For phone case reasons?
Never.
Any,
like, unless you've got a meaningful, like, unless it's an aged... business, like, it's been around for a long time, it's got a meaningful community, maybe like a mission oriented type thing. But this isn't mission oriented, this is just like, there's no
person's using it, I should use it
totally. And as soon as those people stop posting it, which is, I'd want to see like the lumpiness of this revenue.
Yeah, it's probably crazy to zero,
right? I love this. $14 million in annual revenue. They're on pace to hit $20 million in 2024, whatever that means. And the brand has potential to reach $100 million in 3 to 5 years. It's like carnival barking.
Yes.
It had the potential. And why are they selling it then?
Yeah. It's anytime they say that, I will actually reference things they say. I'm like, you said he has potential. And you always talk, like, sellers will say potential. Like, since you love the potential, how about you stay on for 25% and we do an earnout?
Totally.
Like, oh, wait, what?
That's good advice.
And they're like, oh, no, we don't want to do it. I'm like, but you like... the potential, right?
Yeah.
And you don't want the responsibility? I'll take the responsibility with a no-no. They're like, nah. I'm like, all right.
Okay.
So let's talk seriously about this.
But they're clearly, they've thought this through. You wouldn't believe how many brands I see trying to sell. And you'd like, they at least have identified that they've gotten GS1 UPCs.
Yeah.
Some people are like, what's a UPC? Okay. That's tough. So they've got everything in wholesale packaging. They've got wholesale requests. Okay. Like, that could be interesting.
That's
where that goes.
Oh, that's interesting. But also, I've heard that a lot as as a team.
Means nothing.
Exactly. It actually means nothing. Because if it was a good enough deal, they'd bloody be doing it. And they would have done at least one. Why do they have none?
What does this mean? All these territories, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, UK, Mexico, South America. I'm like, oh, so they're selling all over. No, no, no. Have proven to be profitable prospects to scale in for a larger international customer base.
Yeah.
I want to see what does that mean. Like, does that mean that they try running ads in those territories and those proven to be profitable?
Yeah.
If they've tried, why is it not just listed as an international business that's open in all of those markets?
Yes.
Profitable prospects. Like,
are they going to, are you telling me that's all? They're going to need to put all those SKUs in a warehouse for each country.
Oh, yeah. Or you're going to need to do DDP shipping. So you can do like duties delivered paid shipping out of your US based warehouse. But that's going to massively increase your fulfillment costs so that people have a good experience. Otherwise, you're just going to be dealing with chargebacks and returns.
And this is a, what's the word? This, they see Taylor Swift using, they're like, I want this and I want it tomorrow. And if I don't, if I get it in 3 weeks, I want a refund. Because that impulse buy is gone. I'm going to buy this remorse immediately.
Well, look at this. The brand and product mix lends itself well to the subscription model.
Come on.
No.
Okay, this is a product to protect your phone, right? So he should be available.
You should not have to subscribe. This is also, this is, I like this. Finally, the company has initiated discussions with Tapcart, a reputable app responsible for whatever. Tapcart lets you make like apps just based on your Shopify store. Why is that? That's a whole paragraph in here. It would take me 20 seconds to initiate discussions with Tapcart.
It means nothing. Vagueness. Mind you, this is why for me, I don't put the salesmanship into the info.
Yeah.
I put dot points. I'm like, this is what it does. And then I can let the seller think, say what they want to do in one section about what they think the potential is for next moves. But like, don't tell me vague things that mean nothing, because they mean nothing.
Yeah.
And they think you're bullshitting.
Yeah. I really worry about this business. Like, honestly, I have a business that's putting $3 million on the bottom line. It's cash flowing $3 million. That's an amazing business.
Yeah.
That's an amazing lifestyle. Like, if you have one employee and five contracts, for four contracts, just totally five employees, like, I don't know. I suspect someone will end up buying this. I don't know what price they're going to end up buying it for.
I think it'll be listed for a long bloody time, and no one will buy it until it comes down. Or I think this is a business that's listed and never gets sold.
Yeah, if you're that confident.
Because it's too big. Who has that much money, and is that...
For something really new.
Yeah.
Yeah. It scares the shit out of me. They should take the profits that they're making out of this business. They should put them in T-bills and live a fucking incredible life.
Yes.
Like,
and if he has these connections to influencers, that's the UVP of this business.
That must be. I mean, presumably they started this. They're trying to like, they've made it. Get in, get out. And then they go on to start something else.
So on create any product and use your connections, because they're obviously fantastic.
Yeah.
Like, unless they have like a talent agency or someone who's like,
damn it,
that's a good idea. But I don't think so, because you don't see these too often. I've actually never, of all the brands I've looked at, never seen Taylor Swift.
Yeah, that's surprising.
That and Kylie Jenner. Again, I've seen a few. I have a few friends who've done that. But
it's usually she's got equity and stuff. Like, those are, we're talking names where...
Especially now.
Yeah.
In 2016-17, different story. But now, that's very surprising.
I'm surprised.
Yeah.
I'm the geeky, like... These are all, oh, and they keep going. There's a smaller.
Oh, they're huge.
I don't know if you ever...
Selena Gomez. Oh, is Henry Stallone?
Like, what's going on here?
Connections.
What's going on? Have they tapped all the connections and now they're selling it? Like, if you're that good, right? I don't know.
And how are the margins that good if you're paying the celebrities? Because they come to paying the celebrities. These are just... I
don't get it.
I don't want to have this many questions when I'm looking at a business.
No, it scares the shit out of me. It's way too much money to have this many questions. Let's put it on.
Agreed.
So we have the skincare device that, it's called skincare device, but like tough to expand geographically. What were like the big takeaways?
I think
what have you been learning? Did you learn anything?
Yes, still. I think skincare, like I said, it's a small Aussie brand.
Yeah.
For a medium Aussie buyer, who could increase their subscription revenue crazy and bring in other products.
Yeah.
For the kids toy one, you need a very well engineered deal, which we are open to since it's my listing.
Oh, yeah.
The seller wants to stay on, keeping on, like, there's a deal to be negotiated there, and it's SBA-led. So, like, that's going to be a heavy negotiated deal. And like you said, I think bundling is going to be super interesting there.
Just increasing that AOV.
Yeah.
Like, that's going to be super critical. The skincare one, I think they really got to focus on that lifetime value, because their AOV is inherently so low.
I think the garden pond business from website closes. That's,
you're looking at the third lever. Like, you've got to figure out traffic.
There's going to be something else. See, I think with all these, this and all the other old like baby boomer, I want to retire businesses. There's got to be a good, well structured deal. There's got to be. Some other strategy. If it's just SEO that built up over 20 years, I'm calling into question how valuable that is anymore.
Yeah.
I think the last one is, I have 142 questions.
Yeah.
I think none of them are going to be answered to my satisfaction.
No. Fuck away.
It's scary.
Yeah.
At 18 million, like, and the only people we said at that point are super high net worth individuals and
family offices.
Yeah.
Yeah. People were buying businesses often for high net worth individuals' portfolios, in which case, like, why not just start your own?
Yeah, exactly.
So many of these are like, start your own.
And
not a lot of like, product defensibility.
Exactly. It's great that they have IP, valuable IP, but it's not good enough for this niche.
Yeah, and you've always got to be innovating. By the way, like a huge part of phone case businesses is deciding what, because there's minimum orders, right? So when we go to their site, okay, they're making square phone cases for iPhone 7. Like, you have to make a decision at some point. Am I going to place the minimum order required for an iPhone 7? Or like, when do you deprecate it? Like, very complex operation.
Yeah.
You've always got to be coming. You've got to be getting access to, that's one thing we didn't even talk about. You had to be getting access to like, what's the iPhone 16 form factor going to be?
Yeah.
So that you can release those cases right when iPhone comes out.
Yeah.
So like, I mean, that's a crazy.
We have the ability to choose any product to sell. Why choose such a competitive
It's brutal.
Niche?
It's so brutal. This business scares the shit out of me.
Yeah. I'm scared. Cool. And that's it. So those are our listings for this week.
See you next time.